He's the head of the religious studies department, or he's called himself the chair, but I don't like to call people chairs, they can be Then I got to thinking, well, in the Bible they speak about thrones and this and that, so maybe the chair is But he has done research, the thing that really intrigued me, he's done research on the library of the monastery of St. John the Theologian of Patmos, and that has just got me intrigued. It's a fascinating sort of thing. But anyway, he is going to introduce our speaker today, and this is Alan Sparks of the Religious Studies Department, the chair of that, and we're very happy that you're here to introduce.
Numerous colleagues, and a much broader circle of the community as a result of his sustained and deliberate attention to life issues concerning what is known in these reflective circles as self-transformation. It is not the only métier of his scholarship, and he has ranged broadly over the fields of Confucian studies, reflection on the Bhagavad Gita, the great classics of the spiritual traditions in India and in China. And it was one of those happy congruences of time and place that last summer Andreas Brown would give to this university an important collection of materials related to the great thinker of the 20th century, Krishnamurti. Because of the many ways in which Professor Alan Anderson has become known widely, his engagement in the thought of Krishnamurti is one of these jewels. Some of you may know, as many, many others know around the world, of the serious conversations videotaped for the rest of us between Krishnamurti and Professor Anderson. Those conversations, if you have seen them, are themselves a treasure and a challenge, and they objectify an important matter for all universities and for all places of learning, that it is in the quality and the care with which we present our questions that our thought is guided and that our own lives are formed. And whenever a student asks me about the importance of questions, I adduce as evidence for the answer to that Professor Anderson's questions, which formed those conversations with Krishnamurti in, I believe, 1975. If you have not had the opportunity to view some or even all of those videotapes, I encourage you to do so. And I think your appetite for that will be whetted by this opportunity we have to spend, albeit a brief time, with Professor Anderson today. So in introducing him to you, I bear witness to the way in which he is regarded with love and esteem by his colleagues in the university, and by our regret that his retirement has meant that we see him only on very special occasions like this. He needs to hear, as perhaps you might know, and at least surmise, that every time our paths cross, it is a special occasion. Anyway, it is my honor to present to you my colleague, Professor Alan W. Anderson.
Those among us that I've seen before, and some I've known for many years. I see faces, loved long since, or left a while, and on returning, I'm deeply nourished by common concern and abiding care. I have a case here, and I'd like to take out a few materials if you bear with me. Yes, I'm sorry. Thank you for all for this. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
In speaking of friends, I'm reminded that the institution that we call the university is properly a place where friends gather. If it were not for that fact, we should never enjoy authentic dialogue. Dialogue does not take place between enemies. I'm reminded of a verse from the Rig Veda, the 72nd hymn of the 10th book of the Rig Veda, has this to say, that the goddess of speech appears only among friends. The goddess of speech appears only among friends. The inference from that is far-reaching. It suggests, does it not, that where she is not present, only bad ones can take place. So to be among friends and await what I await with great enthusiasm, the period for questions, is to stand with one another as those who share. Unfortunately, education has become increasingly impersonal, and therefore the Socratic method of engaging teacher and student becomes less and less remembered, let alone practiced. I bring this forward simply because I feel it is very critical for our time. Krishnamurti had a passion for what he called sharing, and what he meant by sharing was that the relation between teacher and student ought never to degenerate into one in which the authority is over here and the one over there who needs to shape up to the authority must, under whatever duress, shape up. He opposed that spirit, and he said, both teacher and student begin at the same place, and they never leave it. So, in our own discussion together today, I look forward to our sharing in genuine dialogue some of these issues, some of these enduring questions, which were so very close to his heart. A book will be coming out this year to celebrate the centenary. He was born in 1895. And in this book, there are a number of essays. Persons who wrote them were invited to submit them on the strength of their personal relation to Krishnamurti. And I was honored to be invited to submit one, and I want to read a few paragraphs from it because what I have written here in these paragraphs is a description of my own impression of Krishnamurti. And it might, in that sense, bring us into a closer human relationship. with the man himself. I'm referring here to the 18 dialogues that Krishnamurti and I underwent together in 1974, and the impression that I received has never left me. From the moment we began our conversations, I was struck by his quality of attention. There was nothing contrived about it, nor was it based on a muscular effort of the will to attend. It might be likened on a different level to the dynamic of balance, as when one rides a bicycle, drives a car, or a simple walk. Unless there's a disturbance in the inner ear or other impediment, normal walking is unselfconscious, yet not unconscious. Beyond strength and skill, it entails knack. Knack is a gift. Since most of us walk, there doesn't seem to be much, if anything, of a gift about it. Yet, without knack, our walking would be unspontaneous, graceless, sheerly mechanical, and wooden, puppet-like. Krishnamurti's listening was natural. It had the simplicity and openness of a child, with the alertness of a warrior. It combined the harmlessness of the dove with wisdom of the serpent. This way of being taught me much about education and teaching. It brought home to me why so many gifted students are lost to higher education, their chief complaint being that it all seems unreal, there being no relation shown between thinking one's life and living it. I know of no other way of meeting this objection than through inviting the student to look at his or her conflict of motives through a pure act of attention, not as a positive effort, but as a negative one. That is, since, and I quote Krishnamurti here, in attention there is no exclusion, no resistance, and no effort, and therefore no frontier, no limit, unquote. Negative again, in that a pure act of attention does not open out upon a positive understanding. Rather, it discovers the astonishing sufficiency in just not misunderstanding. Suddenly, the distance between the striver and the goal no longer obtains, for no time elapses between the act of attention and the healing already taking place. Here, timeliness is exact. This negation is not undertaken in order to attain to something better. Krishnamurti puts it precisely. And I'm putting it again now. Negation is to deny what is false, not knowing what is true. I'd like to repeat that. Negation is to deny what is false, not knowing what is true. It is to see the false in the false and to see the truth in the false. And it is the truth that denies the false. You see what is false, and the very seeing of what is false is the truth. That statement has extraordinary implications and ramifications. It upsets our notions of how we come to truth. our notions of how we come to truth proceed from a very different posture. We proceed from what we call knowledge to begin with. But a pure act of attention does not presuppose any knowledge. In 1929, Krishnamurti undertook a remarkable, and for thousands and thousands of people, rather world-shaking event. He had been made head of the Order of the Star in the East in 1911. And on August 2, 1929, that would have made him about 34, he dissolved it. And I should like to read just a little of what he had to say when he stood up and dissolved this order before 3,000 people. We're going to discuss this morning the dissolution of the Order of the Star. Many people will be delighted, and others will be rather sad. It's a question neither for rejoicing nor for sadness, because it is inevitable, as I'm going to explain. You already know the story of how the devil and a friend of his were walking down the street when they saw ahead of them a man stoop down and pick up something from the ground, look at it, and put it away in his pocket. The friend said to the devil, "What did that man pick up?" "He picked up a piece of truth," said the devil. "Well, that's very bad business for you," the friend said. "Oh, not at all," the devil replied. "I'm going to let him organize it." "I maintain the truth is a pathless land. I maintain that truth is a pathless land. And you cannot approach it by any path whatsoever, by any religion, by any sect. That is my point of view. And I adhere to that absolutely and unconditionally. Truth being limitless, unconditioned, unapproachable by any path whatsoever, cannot be organized. Nor should any organization be formed to lead or to coerce people along any particular path. Truth cannot be brought down. Rather, the individual must make the effort to ascend to it. Truth is a pathless land. It doesn't take much imagination to consider how subversive that statement is. On the other hand, if one wished to discover its content, not just the form of its utterance, but its radical content, one would have to embark upon self-inquiry. On my way here, I was thinking, what if someone should ask me today, could you really say in one sentence what the gist of Krishnamurti's teachings really come to? And immediately, the words of the Buddha came to my mind that he pronounced on dying to his favorite disciple, Ananda. "Be a light unto yourself. Be a light unto yourself." He didn't say become a light unto yourself. Be a light unto yourself. The implication being that there's no historical trip to that light in oneself. As we might put it in present-day language, there are no field trips to reality. For reality is neither an event nor an experience. Krishnamurti's teachings never veered from that perspective. And in the title of the topic for today, when I called him prophet, I meant that in a classical sense, not in the sense of a prognosticator, but rather in the sense of a seer. And to speak of self-awakening means to speak of awakening to that light within oneself that never had a beginning and opens out upon no end. Our culture has, since Socrates, moved farther and farther away from genuine self-inquiry. When Socrates said shortly before his execution, "An unexamined life is not worth living," he had reference to self-inquiry. And self-inquiry proceeds by questions, not by answers. To ask oneself the timely question is to put oneself at that time in checkmate, which is not the most comfortable position for any chess player, is it? But I'm most serious when I say to put oneself in checkmate. Then precisely upon that crisis, for if it is not undergone as a crisis, one has not met it. One has not understood the question, or perhaps asked the wrong question. But to stand before that question, hold to it unwaveringly, with no expectation of a reply, no fantasy of what one would like to hear, but simply stand, simply abide. Then the activity of genuine self-inquiry begins. It touches on a region that I have called primal intuition. Not intuition as one of Jung's four functions, which is not clearly differentiated from insight. I'm not talking about insight. Insight has content. Primal intuition has no content. It simply tells one what not to do, not what to do. And if one is sincere, serious, and empty of fantasia, one's question will bring one to precisely that crisis. And it's within that crisis that the light within oneself will return. But it will not return outside my placing myself at risk. the greatest risk of all.